Tonight we start the final section, the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And in the sutta, the translation of the title for this whole section is called Contemplation of Mind Objects. What does that mean? And basically, what the Buddha's done here is he sort of said, well, look what's arising in the mind through this lens or that lens. And it's actually five different lenses that he presents. I will, over the course of the next couple of weeks, talk about three, from my point of view, the most important three of the five. And it's like, oh, here's, like, if you look at it from this angle, then you see how a lot of what's arising in the mind falls into one of these categories, which are typically always, all of these categories are lists. Could be one of these things, right? And I want to start talking about the first of these by reading something from Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight. And he is actually in this writing, paraphrasing a famous sutta of the Buddha's, put into sort of more standard English, I suppose. Imagine yourselves in the middle of a battlefield, single-handedly facing 1,000 enemies. Though surrounded on all sides, you somehow manage to conquer them. Imagine yourself on this battlefield 1,000 different times, and each time you overcome the enemies around you. The Buddha has said that this is an easier task than the conquering of oneself. It's not a trivial thing we have set about doing. The most difficult of all possible tasks is to come to understand one's own mind. But it is not impossible. There have been many beings who have conquered these 1,000 enemies 1,000 times, and they have given us advice and guidance. The first big help is to recognize who the enemies are. Unrecognized, they remain powerful forces in the mind. In the light of recognition, they become much easier to deal with. There are five powerful enemies in the battlefield of the mind, and learning to recognize them is essential to penetrating to deeper levels of understanding. This is an introduction to something called the five hindrances. Sometimes also translated as the five obstructions. So these are mental arises, mental states, moods, emotions. You can think of them in many different ways that seem to get in the way of practice. These are things that arise and we get distracted. Distractions is another good word, actually, I think. So now I want to actually read from the sutta about this, from this section. Okay. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects? Here a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five hindrances. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five hindrances? Here, there being sensual desire in him, a bhikkhu understands there is sensual desire in me. Or there is no sensual desire in him, and he understands there is no sensual desire in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be future non-arisings of abandoned sensual desire. And then he goes on and mentions the other four. There being ill will in him, there being sloth and torpor in him, there being restlessness and remorse in him, there's being doubt in him. So there's the kalesas. Desire, lust, grasping, the first one. aversion, anger, ill will, hatred, annoyance, irritation, so different gradations of that energy. Sloth and torpor, sluggishness of mind, laziness. Restless, worry, regret, agitation, and doubt. These are all things that all of us experience frequently. Some of them more than others, depends on our nature and what's going on in our lives right now. But they're all things that occur in the mind. These are mental arisings. So the first one is lust or grasping or clinging. I've spoken about this before a fair bit, but it's like that energy of wanting, and not only wanting, but wanting so strongly, I want it right now. I don't care what else is going to happen. I got to have this stuff, this thing, this whatever. I want it, and I want it right now. The flip side of that is typically called aversion, but it has all these flavors of anger, ill will, hatred, down to something like annoyance or irritation, which is basically the opposite. It's like, I don't want that. That's unpleasant. I really don't want that. That sort of mental arising. Both of these first two, desire and aversion, usually have very strong stories attached to them. It's like, so what arises in the mind is some story about something that happened in the past or something that might happen in the future or blah, 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 blah. And these stories, which are often very repetitive, have this flavor to them that makes them compelling. I mean, the story, it's like, oh, I got to figure this out. Energy arises because I got to understand why I can't have that stuff, or why I can't get rid of that stuff, or whatever. Or how come I didn't in the past, and how come it's all their fault, and then we get into blame and all that sort of stuff. Or we get into, well, what in the future? Am I ever going to be able to go out for a decent restaurant meal again? Oh, no, maybe not. Worry about the future. I've just been going through that, because am I ever going to be able to teach an actual retreat in a retreat center again? There's been some discussion about that, and it's like, I spent a lot of energy on that one today. Anyhow. So, and then the next two are, once again, a pair, sloth and torpor. So sloth is just basically outright laziness, not really being very energetic, not really putting energy into the practice at all. Just sort of, well, I'll sit here, but yeah. You know, and torpor is more actual fuzziness, I think would be. It's like, yeah, if you sometimes you're sitting and it feels like, you're trying to note things and your mind can't focus on anything. It's like, it's just like this sort of fuzzy, blurry space. Which, by the way, can be quite pleasant sometimes. It's like, oh, I'm just going to hang out in this fuzz land and I don't have to think about anything. I can just be here in this vague sort of spaciness. So sluggishness of mind, those sorts of words. Then the opposite of that is restlessness. This is where my mind is just jumping around from one thing to the next. It's like, I'll think of something for 20 seconds and then 10 seconds later there's something else. And often it's like there's a mind state called papancha, which means basically one thing leads to another. I think of one thing and that makes me think of another thing, which makes me think, and your mind is just like in this stream of consciousness, blah, of just one thing after another, and you're not even settling on anything. And these has often sometimes called agitation as opposed to restlessness. But also, I think this is really important, worry and regret. These are forms of restlessness. Worrying about the future, or regretting what happens in the past. Not that we shouldn't have some thought to the future and how things are going to be, but when we caught in worry, now it's just becoming, it's like just eating at us. And same with regret. We can, yes, we made mistakes in the past. We may even realize, you know, we're sitting there today and we go, oh my God, how could I have ever done that? That's skillful to know that, to see that, but to then dwell on it and continually tell that story again about how I did it wrong and if I'd only said this instead of that and blah, 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 not skillful and not useful. It's just now your mind is distracted by that old story that you're, and you're caught in regret about having done some unskillful thing perhaps. And then the fifth one of these is doubt. Doubt's probably the most insidious of these, because doubt is like, I'm not sure I should even be sitting here right now. and it really has three forms. There's self-doubt. Oh, you know, I'm no good. I can't do this. Who am I fooling? Blah, blah, blah. There's doubt in the practice. Well, yeah, I understand I should have some form of quote, spiritual practice, but this particular form, nah, I should have gone to those Tai Bo classes. They would have been way, is Tai Bo still a thing? I don't know. I should have gone to, you know, the Vajrayana teachings instead of these teachings. You know, we a thousand different things we could think we should do. Or, and this is quite common and having experienced this myself, doubt in the teacher. Yes, I should be practicing. Yes, these teachings make sense, but this person just can't communicate, doesn't really know what they're talking about. You know, I need a better teacher than this. Or I need someone who I resonate with, or, which is sometimes too true, by the way. Sometimes it's skillful to find someone that you resonate with, that you connect with in some way. But I found this mainly on retreats, especially in my early days of retreat. You know, I'd be sitting there, and it's like there's five teachers who are all like really well known. People who've been practicing for a long time, who've been teaching for a long time. And I'd just be sitting there going, God, I wouldn't let these people organize a cat fight. You know, I just like be ranting in my head about how they shouldn't do it that way. They should do it this way. How can they possibly explain it this way? Blah. And it was just blah, 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 blah. It was just doubt in the teachings, teacher. So these are all, the thing with these are all just mental arisings. These are just things that arise in the mind. And like all things that arise in the mind, they arise, they're there for a while, and they're gone. They're impermanent mental arisings. But they seem very permanent, number one, sometimes, and so gripping. Because there's so much emotional content, we get hooked by the emotion, the emotional energy of these things, and spin out. Mentally, we spin out. We're not noting it, we're not paying attention. We're caught up in reliving that story for the 100th time or the 1,000th time and trying to figure it out. And maybe if I'd done this instead of that, and I wish they hadn't said this, or I should, you know, we've all been there. You know what I'm talking about. So what do we do about these things? Because these are called hindrances. These are things that actually get in the way of you actually keeping your mind focused and concentrated. Number one, top level antidote, note them. Know this is what's actually happening. Just see them for what they are. A note of, you know, of anger or lust or sluggishness or worry or regret or doubt or whatever. Just noting them is a very powerful way to soften them. And often once you note them, they just go away. Or if they don't go away, now they're just You're seeing them for what they are. They're just mental stuff that's arisen in the mind, totally randomly, which is the other interesting thing. All those things that arise keep arising in the mind, it's just totally random stuff. Something, some causes and conditions, something that happened earlier on in the day or happened 3 seconds ago in your mind brings rise to this other story. But it's totally random and totally out of your control. If you don't note them, if you don't see them for what they are, the kilesas control you. A fact. You just, basically a lot of the time we're caught in one of these mind states. Once we see them and note them, now they just become objects of meditation. They're just things to note. They've lost their power because we've stepped back from the story enough that we can just see them for what they are. They're just, this is just my mind going blah, blah, blah about this one. And by noting which form it takes, giving it an actual name, it makes it, it's helpful. Now, however, there is another issue here, that this dividing things into these five neat categories is nice and it's useful and it helps us see things. And everything's going to fit into one of those five categories. But that's not really what happens some of the time. Sometimes we have what one of my teachers used to call an MKA, a multiple kilesa attack, where we just get, now we don't get one of these, we get two or three of these all at the same time, and it's just like, oh my God. So it's like we can't, it's like it's nice to have this, these categories, because they fit most situations. But for instance, anger has arisen and we note anger, but if we look often, anger is rooted in either fear. We get into a fearful state and then we get angry that thing is making us so fearful. Or doubt often causes anger because it's like, oh, I shouldn't be, you know, like anger at ourselves. I shouldn't be this way, blah, blah, blah. And we're self-anger. So it's not simple, cut and dry. I only have just to catch one of these five and I'm fine. We have to sort of be aware that they interweave and intermix with each other. So as I said, the very first and the best thing is to be able to just note them. But the problem is, how do we catch ourselves? What is it that gives us, what will help us catch ourselves when the mind is whirling about one of these things? What can I do? So the interesting thing is all of these different mental arisings, these forms of mental arising, have very strong physical correlates. The body reacts to these sorts of emotional energies in very specific ways. It might be everybody's specifics are sometimes slightly different, but basically there's pretty common patterns of how we react. For instance, and I'll go through the five, with grasping, with lust, with strong desire, we lean forward. It's like we're going, I'm on it, and I want it now, and you start actually literally leaning forward to reach for it. Your body leans into desire. You'll be sitting there calmly on your cushion, and you'll notice this sort of leaning forward energy. It's very common. And when you see it, it's like, oh, it's very distinct. Aversion, anger, ill will, always has heat. You know, I was burning with anger is a common English expression, right? It's like the body just feels hot. You may start like, oh my God, I better undo my shirt. And it's just because you're caught up in this angry energy, which literally creates heat in the body. The sloth and torpor is like, as I mentioned earlier, actually, sort of like droopy, fuzzy, sleepy sometimes. It's just like, oh, I sort of start fading. You feel like you're sinking. It's sometimes called, you'll see this this state referred to as sinking mind. Like you think you're doing fine, you're noting, and all of a sudden you notice that you haven't noted in 10 seconds. And it's just, you're sunk into this sort of sloth and torpor state. It has often that sort of sinking, droopy feeling to it. Restlessness is the opposite. It's very jumpy. My mother used to say to me sometimes that she thought I had ants in my pants. And it's a very good description of how you feel. It's like you're shifting around in your chair. And, oh, if I just move this foot 3 centimeters over to the left, then it'll feel right now. And, oh, maybe I should just, stretch my back this way or that way. I mean, we get caught in this state of physical having to just keep moving. We can't sit still. That's restlessness arising. That's the physical manifestation of restlessness. And doubt is tight. When we're in doubt, we feel like we're just closed in, tightened up. It's gripping. Doubt grips us, literally. So often, the first thing we'll know that one of the kilesas has arisen is we'll notice the physical correlate. We'll notice one of these physical sensations and we'll go, oh, look at that, eh? Here I am getting really hot again. Oh, and that'll just, when we can do that, when we can tune into the body, we sort of step back from that story that was running and just tuned into the body and let the sort of noted the body sensation. Just that stepping back and noting the body sensation allows us to sort of tune in to what's going on. This is, remember I mentioned, I think last week I talked about the idea of just dropping a little question into the mind. When you feel like things are sort of chaotic, and like that little question of like, what's going on or what's up? Often you drop into the body and one of these five physical correlates will tell you, oh, that's what's up. I'm caught in that angry old story again, or I'm caught in that old lustful story again, or whatever, Here I am full of doubt again, yes me. Whatever it is, So this is why mindfulness of body comes first. Why we spend so much time and energy focusing on mindfulness of body. Because mindfulness of body is often the very first clue we have that these forms of mental arising, these mind objects, have actually arisen. There they are. Oh, look at that. The other part of this, and this is really important, is when you do note that one of these things has arisen, don't blame yourself. Don't self-blame. Blaming yourself again, oh God, what's wrong with me? There I am, lusting again, or annoyed again, or full of doubt again. Blah, blah, blah. Aren't I a horrible person? We just get caught, and now we've added doubt and aversion on top of the original, the original energy. We just made it more, we generated our very own MKA just like that. So it's not skillful to blame. And it's the thing you really have to watch for when you start working with kilesas is not going playing that blame game with yourself because it just makes it worse. It's like, oh, I'm angry. And that's okay. I'm a human being. Sometimes that's what happens, Now I'm going to step back and note it, pay attention to it. So I also want to read, oops, have a big pile of books for this one. I want to read a little something from, this is from Bhikkhu Anileo's book on Satipatthana. And he's talking about, why did the Buddha separate out these particular mind states? Why did he highlight them, make them the very first thing to pay attention to in the fourth foundation of mindfulness? Why are these particular mind objects highlighted? And Anileo has something really interesting to say here, I think. The use of the term hindrance clearly indicates why these mental qualities have been singled out for our special attention. They hinder the proper functioning of the mind. Under the influence of the hindrances, one is unable to understand one's own good or that of others, or to gain concentration or insight. Learning to withstand the impact of a hindrance with awareness, noting what we've been talking about, is therefore an important skill for one's progress on the path. According to the discourses, difficulties in counterbalancing a hindrance are a good reason for approaching an experienced meditator to ask for practical guidance. These five hindrances actually cover seven distinct mental qualities. This is one interpretation. These seven are subsumed under the fivefold presentation. It's probably due to the similarities in effect and character between sloth and torpor, and between restlessness and worry. They're related. According to the commentaries, this fivefold presentation makes it possible to correlate each hindrance with one of the mental factors needed to attain absorption, which is something called the seven factors of awakening, which is what we're going to talk about next week. What he's saying here is these five factors are all directly related to wholesome mind states that are the antidotes to these five unwholesome mind states, that are part of something called the seven factors of awakening, which is another layer of the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which I'm going to talk about next week. So I just thought that, like, he says that very clearly. The hindrances not only obstruct absorption attainment, they also impede the establishment of the awakening factors. This antagonistic relationship between the hindrances and the awakening factors is of considerable importance, since the removal of the former and the development of the latter are necessary conditions for enlightenment. Pretty clear. This is important stuff, is what he's saying here. So I want to talk about, well, I've got a lot to talk about tonight. In the sutta, that actually the Buddha talked about more than just recognizing them when they're present. He actually talked about, for each of the kleshas, five sort of flavors, in a sense, of noting them. Know when it's present. We've talked a lot about that up until now. But also know when it's absent, which is exactly the thing we talked about when we talked about mental factors back last week. It's really important that we note everything's fine. That, and this is often after we've been caught in a kalesa storm. And then it's like, because it's like everything else that arises is there for a while, it's gone. Then it's gone and it's like, this is kind of nice. It's quiet. And we note the absence of what had been hindering us, what we'd been caught in. It's very skillful and very important that we do this, because otherwise it's very easy to turn this whole teaching into a really seemingly skillful way to just beat yourself up over and over and over again. It just becomes this very spiritual, skillful way to crap all over yourself yet again. It's just so easy to do that. But if we start to note the absence, then we see, the wholesome is also here. And that's really important. And then he says, and this is, remember, these are called contemplations. So know what can cause it to arise. So this is almost stepping out into our larger life in some sense. This is what he's talking about here, is the importance of leading a life of virtue. Many of these kalesas are directly related to acting in an unvirtuous way out in the world. There's often straight line relationships between these things. Not all of us, because many of these things are just stories from our past, or our worries about the future, or something, you know, we saw on TV on Tuesday night that just freaked us out, or whatever, speaking personally. But it's like we have to know what it is, what patterns in my life or in my mental processes lead me to be caught in one of these things. And then how do we remove, if one of these things has arisen, how do we remove them? Well, we've already talked about the main way to remove them is to note them. And the other main way is to be able to drop into the body, step away from the story, tune into not the mental arising, but the physical sensation that is directly caused by that mental arising in many cases. And tune in on that level. Now it's just like I'm being mindful of the body and I'm not caught in that story anymore. This is the skillful way to remove these things often. And when I say remove, don't think for one second that means the story is going to stop. Often these stories are so powerful and so habitual, the story is still running. But as long as I'm mindful, as long as I see, this is just that story. Sometimes it's like you even have notes for particular stories, you know, things that recur over and over again, you know, some past event with some family member or someone you used to work with, or some politician that drives you crazy. These are all just mental arisings, right? And it's like, oh, and so I've actually at times had names for some of these things. I had this recurring thing going on in my mind that about something that happened 30 years ago when I was doing some dealings with Microsoft back in my computer days that went very bad. And I was just like, I'd get caught in this rant about it. I'm just like, rrr, rrr, rrr. And it's like, I'd see it and I'd go, oh, Microsoft story. That was my note. And it was like, oh, it's just that. And it was just, that was that. It would just sort of go away often. It lost its power. It could be weird boss story. It could be who knows what it is. I mean, we all have those stories. And then the last of his list of five things is know how to keep it from coming back. This is like, what can I do to just let go of that story completely? It's like, I don't need I see that story coming. Often, you know, I see the train coming down the track and I just go, yeah, I don't need to go there. Just let it go. I know it's not skillful. I know it's not helpful. I can just let it go. Okay, so one other thing I want to read. This is another, this is the topic, by the way, the Buddha talked about a lot. But there's another famous sutta where he gives classical similes that describe various states that a pond might take that are similes for these various mind states. The ideal being, of course, that the pond is perfectly clear and perfectly still. And I look into the pond and I see myself for as I really am. That would be the ideal pond in this set of similes. Okay. And he's actually explaining this to a Brahmin. So there's a, so suppose, Brahmin, there's a bowl of water mixed with lac, turmeric, blue dye, or crimson dye. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. This is a simile describing desire or lust. It's like our mind is colored by those emotions, so we don't see clearly. We get, the mind gets colored, and we start to believe that it's okay. Oh, it'll be okay this time, blah, 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 you know, whatever, you know. We're not seeing clearly because we're looking through, you know, the expression, looking through rose-colored glasses. So along that, only there could be a lot of different colors of glasses, right? But it's like that's the image is a pool, water that's relatively speaking clear, except it's got this color in it. So now I look into it and I see my face, but my face is now bright red, which isn't actually what my face looks like. Okay. Then he goes on to the next one. Suppose, Brahman, there's a bowl of water heated by a fire, bubbling and boiling. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. This is that anger, aversion, energy. It's like a pot of boiling water. You know, you try look. You look. First of all, looking down into a pot of boiling water is really uncomfortable. All that heat on your face, but also it's like you can't possibly see anything clearly because it's like all these bubbles. And but it's heat is the thing there. Suppose, Brahman, there's a bowl of water covered over with plants and algae. This is sloth and torpor. It's like you look, but it's just like you can't see anything clearly. It's all fuzzy and messy and just isn't, there's no clarity at all. Then suppose, Brahman, there's a bowl of water stirred by the wind, rippling, swirling, churned into wavelets. So here the surface of the mind, right, we're talking about the surface here, is this sort of shaking. It's like moving around. There's no clarity. You'd never get to see your face clearly because it's all jagged and jumping around and shifting, and different parts are reflected at different times in different ways. It's agitated. It doesn't sit still for a second. And the final image. Suppose, Brahman, there's a bowl of water that is turbid, unsettled, muddy, placed in the dark. Well, it's pretty hard to see yourself clearly in a bowl of water like that. Turbid is like swirling around, right? Muddy, placed in the dark. You're not going to see yourself very clearly. And the reason I mentioned these images at all is for some people, images like this are quite helpful in that recognition stage. It's like, you know, that what's going on question, it might be, oh, my mind's sort of like one of those muddy ponds, or there's scum on top of my mind, or my mind is boiling. You see, so these images are useful, particularly in that recognition stage, as a way of tuning into what's actually arising, which is why I think, plus, I just like the images themselves are kind of cool. So that's why I mentioned them. So that's all I wanted to say about this topic, which was quite a lot. but I think it's, I want to go back to the key point here. The most important thing we can do is note the arising of these mind states. If we can note them, if we can actually go, anger, and it's not, It's not I'm angry. Now you're just making more self. It's anger has arisen. Lust has arisen. It's a different flavor. And it might just be the note is lust or anger, but it's like you gotta be careful not to make it personal. It's not you having these emotions. It's just these things have arisen in this flow of mind that you are aware of. It's a different way of looking at it. Don't make these personal in any way. Yeah, you have to sort of to see them for, they're just stuff that's happening. This is what I'm noting now. I'm noting this thing arising in this mind space. That's all. It's not, they don't in any way define you. You're just noting them, seeing them for what they are, seeing how they get in the way of the mind being still and focused and concentrated, of actual mindfulness arising. You can't be mindful. It's very difficult to be mindful when the mind is caught in one of these stories and all whirling around. You can be mindful of the story itself and see the mind state itself for what it is. Now you step back from the story. Now it's just what's arisen now and you're being mindful of it. Perfectly good mindfulness practice. Because you see it, you know, if mindfulness is about seeing things as they are, this is what are now. This is mind full of this nonsense. That's all. Just what's happening now. It's not like anything other than that. It's just mental arisings. Totally out of your control, by the way, of course. Okay. So at this point, I'd like to sit for about, I talked longer than usual, 25 minutes perhaps. And those of you who are listening to this recording, you should at this point pause the recording, and after you've sat for a while, come back and listen to the rest of it. So once again, finding that comfortable, upright, meditative position. Closing your eyes if that's how you normally practice. One last thing about the kilesas. I've talked so much about them. The temptation is going to be to go out looking for them. I got to be on the lookout, me. I'm going to see five great kilesas. And don't go looking for kilesas. They'll find you anyway. You don't have to go looking for them. They'll turn up. Just be aware of them when they come without trying to generate them or in any sense. Just have it in the, maybe at the, right at this point, sort of make a little resolution to, okay, I'm going to try and be aware of kilesas if they arise and note them. And just leave it at that without having to turn it into a search party for kilesas, which will just make you miserable. So there's that calm, steady, upright position. I'm going to turn off my mic and we can just sit. Often do. I want to read you a poem. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Thirst. And I love this poem because it, in some senses, talks about the kilesas, not exactly the same words, but this is a poem called When Roses Speak, I Pay Attention. As long as we are able to be extravagant, we will be hugely and damply extravagant. Then we will drop foil by foil to the ground. This is our unalterable task, and we do it joyfully. And they went on, listen, the heart shackles are not, as you think, death, illness, pain, unrequited hope, loneliness, but lassitude, rue, vainglory, fear, anxiety, selfishness. Their fragrance all the while rising from their blind bodies, making me spin with joy. I love this. That spin with joy just does it to me every time. So, but it's she's talking about the same thing. So let's dedicate to Merit. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for your kind attention. I'll see you all.